From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Jakarta Governor Jokowi wins Indonesia's presidency. Cambodia's Hun Sen, opposition leader, announced deal ending deadlock. Australian Prime Minister alleges cover-up at MH17 crash site. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. After a drawn-out election process and dual claims to the presidency, Indonesia has officially announced Joko Widodo, widely known as Jokowi, as the country's next president. But as Kate Lamb reports from Jakarta, the result comes after his rival pulled out of the race and alleged widespread fraud.
After the initial confusion of the dual claims, it became increasingly clear over the past 2 weeks that Jakarta's wildly popular governor, Joko Widodo, is the winner of this year's extremely tight presidential election. The coalition of his rival, former Army General Prabowo Subianto, has continued to fracture, while the polling institutions that called a Subianto win on election day have refused to be audited. In an impassioned speech just hours before the official results were announced Tuesday, Subianto declared he was pulling out of the race.
Lima, telah terjadi kecurangan yang masif.
Speaking to his supporters in East Jakarta, Subianto said the election was neither clean nor fair and was tainted by widespread fraud. We use our constitutional right to reject this presidential election, which is legally flawed, he said, and therefore are withdrawing from the process. Subianto had been working toward becoming president for the past decade and previously said he would accept the official decision. In a country where voting takes place on thousands of islands and where ballots are checked at several levels before being sent to the National Commission, it takes weeks before the final tally is announced. After tabulating more than 130 million votes, the National Elections Body announced late Tuesday that Widodo and his running mate, Yusuf Kalla, had won with 53% of the total vote.
Saudara Insinyur Ha Joko Widodo.
Widodo and Kalla, set to be inaugurated on October 20, will lead Indonesia for the next 5 years. The election of 53-year-old Widodo, a former furniture entrepreneur and mayor of Solo, will be the first Indonesian president with no ties to Suharto's 32-year reign that ended in 1998. Widodo's supporters hope he can usher in an era of change, transparency and clean governance, characteristics that propelled him to national prominence during his time as Jakarta governor. After a decade in power, Indonesia's current president, Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, is stepping down after serving the maximum 2 5-year terms. For VOA News, this is Kate Lamb, Jakarta.
For more perspective on the outcome of Indonesia's election, we turn to Ambassador Jay Stapleton Roy, currently a distinguished scholar and founding director emeritus of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars here in Washington. As a 3-time U.S. ambassador, he was the U.S. envoy to Indonesia from 1996 through 1999. Speaking with VOA Indonesian journalist Arif Budiman, Ambassador Roy assesses what's ahead for President-elect Joko Widodo and the state of democracy in Indonesia.
I think the number one priority when he takes office, of course, is to staff his government. He needs to appoint his top ministers and get a functioning government up and running as quickly as possible. I think the big challenge he will face is sustaining economic growth for Indonesia. One of his major challenges as a president will be to develop a good grasp of the national security and foreign policy issues that Indonesia is facing. He will need to get to know international leaders, and he will need to have advisors who can assist him in dealing with these complex problems.
Do you think Joko Widodo has potential to face the foreign challenges once he takes the office?
Well, he has been governor of Jakarta for several years now, and he earlier had his experience in Solo. He has created confidence among many Indonesians that he has the qualities necessary to be president of the fourth largest country in the world in terms of population. I think he starts with a strong expression of confidence on the part of Indonesians that he has those qualities. And so his challenge will be to strengthen that confidence.
What do you think of state of democracy in Indonesia?
I think Indonesia shows that it has a very healthy and vibrant democracy, but that, after all, we in the United States have had democracy for over 200 years, and we had a dispute over the outcome of our elections in 2000, just 14 years ago, that required the Supreme Court to become involved for the first time in our history. So I think the potential dispute over the outcome of this election does not mean that democracy is not working in Indonesia, but it shows that democracy does not provide easy solutions to the types of problems that are involved in selecting leaders in big countries.
What do you think of the relationship between Indonesia and United States will be with the new Indonesian president?
I think the United States would be able to deal with whoever emerges as the president of Indonesia. In other words, the question of who should be president of Indonesia is not for the United States to decide, but for the people of Indonesia to decide. And they now have the mechanism for making that decision, and I think we should let that mechanism work.
You haven't answered about what is the most difficult foreign challenge facing by the new president. Is it dealing with China or what?
Well, I think there are some negative trends in East Asia, and these are very important to Indonesia because Indonesia's economic success has been achieved largely during a period of stability and peace in East Asia. So I think that there's no question that Indonesia should be concerned about the tensions between China and Japan, over the disputes in the South China Sea that could potentially result in conflict if not handled properly. And I would hope that Indonesia will use its influence to try to restore a positive outlook in East Asia, where the tensions between the various countries there over territorial issues are handled in a way that does not threaten the future of continued economic growth and peace in the region.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Indonesia, Jay Stapleton Roy. Cambodia's Prime Minister and opposition parties have announced an agreement ending nearly a year of political deadlock that is expected to enable the National Assembly to fully reopen. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
The agreement between Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen and opposition leader Sam Rainsy followed 5 hours of closed-door talks Tuesday, the third round of discussions since the opposition Cambodian National Rescue Party boycotted parliament after the July 2013 elections. The opposition had refused to take up their 55 seats in parliament, alleging the polls were rigged. They had called for reforms before fresh elections. In the settlement, both sides agreed to work together at the National Assembly to solve major issues and reform independent institutions to benefit the nation, the people, and democratic pluralism. Sim Suya, director of the Khmer Institute for Democracy, said the agreement marked a major step forward after the year of political conflict.
Really congratulate both parties for political maturity as of today. I guess if both parties work together, Cambodia will develop faster and in a more egalitarian society. This is a very positive step, and I think that this is a very promising future for Cambodia. So I think this is the beginning of everything good.
The agreement was also marked by steps to release 7 opposition lawmakers and a party activist detained last Tuesday after violence erupted near Freedom Park in Phnom Penh, in clashes with security guards when the opposition attempted to stage a rally. The lawmakers were facing charges ranging from insurrection to inciting violence that carry possible lengthy jail terms if found guilty. Mr. Hun Sen has been in power for almost 3 decades and is known for his autocratic style of government, but was all smiles at the end of the talks, calling them a success. Sam Rainsy, who had spent several years in exile before returning to Cambodia just prior to last year's elections, flew to Phnom Penh Saturday, saying that talks were the only solution to the political deadlock. Political scientist Carl Thayer of the Australian-based University of New South Wales says that although the agreement draws Sam Rainsy back into the political process, the political outlook remains uncertain.
I mean, the way Hun Sen plays the game in the past has meant any time an arrangement like this could be completely overturned if the opposition takes a stance or does things that he disagrees with. But I'm not going to be overwhelmingly optimistic, or I'm not going to be completely convinced they've turned a corner until we've seen the passage of time.
The talks also settled on pressing on with new elections, but no final date has been set. Under the existing election timetable, Cambodia had been due for new national polls in July 2018. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Daybreak Asia has often explored the growing number of foreign students enrolled in U.S. universities. Later on today's program, we'll see what's happening at the high school level. Australia's Prime Minister is alleging a cover-up amid tampering of evidence at the Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 crash site in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Russia's ambassador to Malaysia denies the plane's black boxes were opened before they were handed over to Malaysian officials. VOA correspondent Steve Herman has details from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says Russia's President Vladimir Putin has so far been as good as his word by approving a UN Security Council resolution guaranteeing safe access for international monitors at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. But Mr. Abbott, speaking to reporters in Canberra, complains about what has been happening amid the bodies and wreckage before investigators arrived. He describes the most recent video from the scene as looking like a building demolition.
After the crime comes the cover-up. What we have seen is evidence tampering on an industrial scale, and obviously that has to stop.
Malaysian officials have taken possession of the downed plane's cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. They were handed over by pro-Russia separatists who control the area where the Boeing 777 came down in pieces last Thursday. All 298 people aboard died. Malaysia's Prime Minister Najib Razak negotiated directly via telephone with a rebel leader to arrange the handover of the aircraft's so-called black boxes. He also says the agreement includes releasing all human remains and full access to the site by an international team.
Only then can the investigation into MH17 truly begin. Only then can the victims be afforded the respect they deserve.
A White House spokesman reacting to the Malaysian leader's active engagement with the separatists in Ukraine called it entirely understandable considering the circumstances. Malaysia lost 44 citizens on the plane. The Netherlands had 198 of its citizens on the plane. At least 27 Australians were on the flight. Those countries are joining the United States and Ukraine in blaming the crash on a surface-to-air missile fired by separatists in eastern Ukraine. The degree of Russia's responsibility and involvement in a possible cover-up are being intensely discussed in the diplomatic and intelligence communities. Russia's ambassador to Malaysia, Ludmila Vorobieva, on Tuesday denied any such involvement of her government or that of the separatists.
The rebels do not possess any defense systems that are capable of shooting a plane at the altitude of 10 kilometers. They do not have this kind of systems. Russia has never supplied this kind of system.
The ambassador says the West is playing games, blaming someone and accusing some parties without any evidence. After the ambassador's remarks to reporters, several hundred protesters organized by the youth wing of Malaysia's largest political party gathered outside the Russian embassy. Placard-waving demonstrators chanted, "We want justice." The downing of Flight 17 is the second tragedy this year for Malaysia and its flag carrier. Its Flight 370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing vanished on March 8th after veering far off course, and no trace of it has been found. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
A top American diplomat says the United States believes Pakistan's counterinsurgency operation in North Waziristan has pushed the militant Haqqani network out of the country's volatile tribal region in the northwest. U.S. Special Representative for Pakistan and Afghanistan, James Dobbins, said Tuesday the United States will continue to provide humanitarian assistance to those displaced by the offensive. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad.
Ambassador James Dobbins is visiting Pakistan and Afghanistan to discuss political as well as security issues with leaders in both countries. A day after meeting senior political and military officials in Islamabad, he told reporters in Kabul that talks revolved around the Pakistani army's anti-militancy operation in Pakistan's North Waziristan tribal district.
The operation in North Waziristan seems to be quite a massive operation. The army has taken a number of casualties. It's inflicted an even larger number of casualties on both the domestic and foreign militants in the area, including Afghan. It's seized huge amounts of ammunition, of IED precursor material, bomb-making facilities, particularly in Miram Shah.
Pakistan's army says it has so far killed more than 500 militants linked to the Pakistani Taliban and its Uzbek allies. The military claims to have cleared North Waziristan's central town of Miran Shah and adjoining areas of militants and has confirmed the deaths of at least 32 soldiers. In addition to being a hub of domestic militants, the Waziristan region has also served as a major base for the Al-Qaeda-linked Haqqani network, which has launched deadly attacks on Afghan and U.S.-led coalition forces across the border in Afghanistan. The militant network is a close ally of the Afghan Taliban and has alleged links to the Pakistani spy agency. Ambassador Dobbins also responded to concerns that the Pakistani military offensive did not directly target the Haqqani network and other fugitive Afghan insurgents.
As regards the Haqqani network, we believe that they, like other militants, have in fact been pushed out of North Waziristan, and our concern is whether they would come back or be allowed to operate elsewhere in Pakistan. We've been assured by the Pakistani government that they will not be allowed back into North Waziristan, and they will not be allowed to operate from elsewhere in Pakistan, and we will, of course, be observing that carefully.
Dobbins said the military offensive has displaced nearly the entire population of North Waziristan. He noted that the U.S. is providing aid for the internally displaced people and will also assist in reconstruction efforts when the army operation is completed. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Following Daybreak Asia and the latest world news on International Edition, we invite you to stop by our program page at voanews.com/Daybreak Asia. More than 73,000 students currently enrolled in U.S. high schools have come from other countries. The statistic is one of the findings of a report released this month by the Institute of International Education. The report finds a huge increase in the number of international students enrolled directly in U.S. secondary programs, which more than tripled from the fall of 2004 to the fall of 2013. The International Institute of Education is the same organization that each year releases a report on international college and university students in the United States in the annual Open Doors Report. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with one of the researchers on the high school report. Rajika Bhandari is Deputy Vice President of Research and Evaluation for the Institute of International Education.
There were some really surprising parallels between the trends that we see for international students at the post-secondary level and students coming in at the high school level. And that's similar to what we see for colleges and universities, that really when we're looking also at secondary level mobility, the scenario is dominated by students from Asia. Most of them, among the Asian students, most of them tend to be from China and South Korea. And now, one of the interesting differences, however, when we're looking at students from Asia and as we're comparing and contrasting trends at the post-secondary level and the secondary level, is that the one group of students who did not really figure in this, the mobility picture at the secondary level, are Indian students. So there were some interesting parallels, but then there were also some key differences where you, if you're looking at Asian students as a group, we the group that we don't find coming to the U.S. at the secondary level is students from India.
Why is it that Chinese students, other Southeast Asian students, are in greater numbers coming to study in secondary schools? What are the chief reasons behind that?
I think the chief reason is that it is a sort of trickle-down effect of the same factors that we see at the higher education level. Chinese students, and I would go so far as saying most Asian students, but certainly students from China, students from South Korea, are extremely focused on academic rigor, on obtaining a high-quality, competitive global education. And that's one of the reasons, key reasons, that drives many of them to seek an overseas education at the post-secondary level. However, what we are now seeing is that these students are possibly trying to study overseas at a younger age because they might perceive that it'll actually help position them better and to be more competitive as they try and gain entry into U.S. higher education. So it's really serving the fact that they're coming to the U.S. and I should mention that many of the students from Asia are obtaining full diplomas from a U.S. school. Clearly indicates that their intent is perhaps to then use that as a pathway to then apply to a U.S. institution. We know from our interviews with various schools that that when Chinese and students are looking at different schools and trying to decide between different secondary schools, they're really, really focusing on what might be considered a handful of indicators of academic rigor. So they're looking at how many AP classes a school offers. They're looking at what might be the average SAT scores. And they're looking at what sorts of colleges and universities students from that school are likely to get admission to. So really, they're looking at all of those aspects which might make them very competitive in terms of obtaining a higher education in the U.S.
Now, a lot of foreign students have matriculated in public universities in the United States. Is that the same case in this study for secondary schools?
No, it's in fact the opposite. Most international students coming to the U.S. at the secondary level are based in private high schools. And there are a couple of very clear reasons for that. The overarching reason is that for those students wishing to obtain a full high school diploma from a U.S. school, and we know that that's 67% of all international students coming at the secondary level, for those students, they can actually not do that at a public school because current immigration regulations will not permit them to remain at a public high school for longer than a year. So most of them are really looking to private schools where they can gain admission and then stay there for the requisite number of years where they can actually matriculate and get their diploma.
Rajika Bhandari, Deputy Vice President of Research and Evaluation for the Institute of International Education, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. We invite you to stay tuned for the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
To really understand what's happening today, take a look at what happened yesterday.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese